Good morning. You're listening to PSA Today, a community forum for public affairs hosted by Jessica Levity for Wilkes Broadcast Group in Reno. The purpose of this 30-minute show is to give a platform to our local community builders and to promote public service. So sit back, relax, and learn what your fellow citizens are up to.
Good morning and welcome to PSA Today. On today's show, for the first time ever, I have author and a Colorado man who ran a Boston Marathon four times in a row in one day. It's David Clark. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today. We're in Reno. Where are you?
I am in Denver, Colorado, actually just outside of Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, great. So your autobiography, best-selling autobiography, about your path to recovery is called Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery. Tell me a little bit about your story.
Yeah, so my trajectory into the world of ultra marathon running has been, you know, not your standard route. In fact, I hadn't run at all until late in life, in my 30s. And when I started, I was actually a 320-pound guy. So
oh
I wasn't
God.
A fleet-footed, skinny runner, to say the least. In fact, I was battling a host of things. You know, I was chronically overweight, and I was struggling with addiction, substance abuse, and all kinds of things. So I kind of discussed that and what the journey was from that, you know, really dark place to ultra marathon running and doing stuff like that.
So is ultra marathon running a thing? I've never heard of that. So it's not just like you ran the marathon four times a row in a day because you invented that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did invent that particular event, but now there's a whole slew of crazy people out there that you haven't heard of that compete in, you know, races that are 50 and 100 miles in length and longer even. And you know, it's kind of an underground sport at this point, but it's kind of growing.
Okay, so you're okay and comfortable with the fact that the rest of us do think of you as crazy.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of been my comfort zone for as long as I can remember. So, in fact, I say crazy is a really powerful tool, so you can use it for good in life.
So let's talk about you as a child. What were some of these circumstances that you experienced as a kid that you feel like shaped a huge part of your life?
You know, my childhood was you know, very unconventional, to say the least, but you know, I think that, you know, there is really no such thing as normal, I like to say. You know, that concept of normal, you know, kind of really causes us to get lost. And I'm no exception to that. My childhood, you know, from the time I was about 6 years old and on, I was traveling the country. I lived, you know, in and out of temporary housing. You know, sometimes we were living in campgrounds or shelters or churches, and other times we were, you know, a little more stable. But you know, overall, there was just no stability in my life at all for the time, you know, the formative years from the time I was like five until into my teens. And, you know, obviously everything that we go through as children is going to have an effect on us, you know. But I think what it really did is it kind of made me feel like I was detached from society, you know, or outside of what the norm was. Even though it was kind of unconventional circumstances that led me to that point, I think it was a very common place to be, you know, to feel that you don't belong. And later in life, that caused me, you know, a lot of strife.
Absolutely. So you actually mentioned that in your 20s, you received a lot of success. And after such humble beginnings, what do you think caused you to spiral downward instead of that success creating happiness for you?
You know, I think it took me a long time to really break that question down, you know, that whole concept down and make some sense to it, honestly. I mean, it is a confusing thing, but, you know, I think to the best of my understanding, you know, whenever we look outside of ourselves, you know, for anything, for happiness or for comfort or, you know, for any type of justification, you know, it kind of creates this scenario where, you know, happiness is never present. You know, it's never in your daily or current life. So you're always looking outside to, you know, if I only had this, if I only had that, you know, then I'd be happy. And so I kind of went on that trajectory. You know, I started being very aggressive in my goals, and you know, I worked my way through college, and I started my own company, and you know, made a a lot of money. We did $8 million the first year I owned my company. And, you know, all I did is kind of fed that place that said, you know, because obviously that didn't make me happy. I felt like it would if I could get there. And then once I got there, I still wasn't happy. So it made it even worse somehow, because now now you have all this stuff and you're really not happy. So what's really wrong with you? How messed up are you, you know?
Yeah. Do you describe yourself as happy now?
I do. You know, I think that, you know, we're taught this concept of, you know, you hear this advice all the time, you know, about, you know, you do what makes you happy, or, you know, life's too short, you know, find the right job or chase your dreams. It'll make you happy. And, you know, obviously there's some truth to that. But for me, it was, I couldn't be happy in anything that I was doing. So it really didn't matter what I was chasing. And now it's kind of come full circle. You know, I can be happy in anything that's going on in my life, which frees me to kind of pursue the things that I'm more passionate about, you know, the things that are going to, you know, really make me come on fire, you know, or, you know, really explode with that passion and that commitment and that, you know, almost crazy desire to make things happen.
I love that. So your autobiography out there, A Story of Ultra Recovery. Can you describe to me the difference between what you would call recovery versus ultra recovery?
Well, you know, the only reason I use that word ultra in there is to kind of give, you know, potential readers, an indication that it wasn't just a normal version of recovery, that it had some ultra component to it. I think it probably seems a little strange to people that, you know, someone would go to such extremes to find balance, you know, and, you know, why would you run 100 miles to find balance in your life? You know, that doesn't make sense. But I wanted to put that in the title that for me, my journey, you know, being a former 320-pound alcoholic drug addict, that's probably not going to relate to your average person. Right. But I think we all want to change, right? We all know that there's a better version of ourselves inside. So I kind of wanted that to be in the title that, you know, it wasn't enough for me to let go of drugs and alcohol, but I wanted to create a powerful and passionate life that was worth living, you know, not just one that was free of addiction.
Yeah, beautiful and well said. And I'm glad you brought up balance. This is a concept that I've really been exploring for myself lately. So I'm curious, you know, extreme running, definitely running 100 miles or running the Boston Marathon 4 times in 1 day is definitely extreme. So how do you feel like running is now balanced in your life? And do people say that now you've just replaced your other addictions with running? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, I get that. I get two questions. I'm also a vegan.
Yeah.
And the two questions I get all the time are, where do you get your protein and did you trade addictions?
Classic.
And, you know, they're great questions, and I certainly understand why someone would get the impression that it's a trading of addictions or a swapping, you know. And I try not to get too caught up in, you know, defending that, you know, or even feeling the need to defend that, but I think it speaks to kind of maybe a lack of understanding of what addiction really is. And, you know, addiction has a very dark, compulsive, and destructive component to it. You know, we can't be addicted to something that, you know, that brings peace to our lives. You know, we can't be addicted to loving our kids too much or, you know, going to church or being on a spiritual journey. But we can be addicted to things that, you know, when it switches over to that addiction thing, you're kind of engaging in it compulsively despite negative consequences.
Okay.
So running can most definitely fit that description, you know, and you see it all the time, the runner who runs themselves, you know, into injury and kind of breaks themselves down. But for me, I have to be ever conscious of that, right? I would say that, like, my running has to resemble my recovery and not my addiction. And whenever I feel it getting that way, that's when I know it's time to ease back.
Okay, so you check in with yourself every day to see where you're at in that balance game.
Yeah, you know, I do. I think that, you know, all emotions are kind of appropriate. You know, it's okay to experience the whole gamut of human emotion as long as it's, you know, matched up to the right circumstance. And I always joke that alcoholics have that totally backwards, right? they'll always put anger where they're supposed to be happy or depression where they're supposed to be considerate. And we never get it matched up right, you know. So
yeah.
I make sure that my commitment level matches, you know, something that's going to use that to a healthy outcome instead of a destructive one. So constant checking in and constant, you know, stepping back as well.
That's great. So you talked about you achieved all of this money and success in your 20s, and that's not what brought you happiness. And then in your book, you talk about that it's a healthy mind and body where you finally found peace. How did running contribute to that health in your mind and body?
You know, running for me is, so when I found sobriety, when I just kind of drew that line in the sand and said that, you know, I didn't know what my life was going to look like moving forward, but I was pretty sure what I didn't want it to look like. And that's what it looked like then. I didn't want it to look like that anymore. And at that point, you know, it kind of started a discovery journey of sorts. And I truly believe that I could have used anything to go on that journey. I happened to choose running. It could have been music or writing or mountaineering or just about anything. But running became this kind of affirmation of forward movement and you know, that journey towards, you know, looking inside. And what made running so perfect for me was that it had a physical aspect of it that I desperately needed. I mean, I was 320 pounds. I was under a doctor's care for, my heart was beating so rapidly that if I started laughing real hard, I would pass out because my brain couldn't get the blood, my heart couldn't get the blood to my brain fast enough.
Wow.
And you know, I had high blood pressure and I was, you know, my doctor said I was going to have a stroke any minute, you know, and so I needed something to physically change and kind of heal myself, you know. I wasn't just an alcoholic and an overweight person. I was a broken person. And so the running kind of took care of that physical component. I needed to start feeling better. I needed to, my body to start changing and responding. And the physical or the spiritual kind of mind component of that was the discipline required to go do something as difficult as running, you know, was something that just didn't exist in my life as an addict. You know, I mean, I couldn't get myself to do anything. Which was such a crazy departure from my days when I had the company. You know, I had to be on top of a lot of issues and employees and multiple locations. And when my business went away and I, you know, fell full into addiction, I couldn't manage myself at all. So, you know, running became this really easy task. It was like, simple, man. You don't want to go back to your old life? Get out the door and run. And then figure out how to be okay with the pain you're experiencing. You know, how do you deal with that mentally? So it allowed me to develop a set of coping skills that, you know, didn't involve using drugs and alcohol. And so that kind of started the process of the mental aspect of it as well. So, you know, inadvertently, I kind of accidentally stumbled on this process that allowed me to address all of those things that I so desperately needed to look at in my life.
That's great. I think you really just hit something on the head right there with learning to just accept the pain that's going to happen, because I think a lot of people who have some kind of recovery to go through, especially when it comes to being overweight, they want it to be easy. And
Yeah. So
they go onto a new path of working out or exercising or something physical like that. And when it's not easy, they beat themselves up and they get really defeated. And I think if you can have that attitude that you just described of saying, this isn't going to be easy, it is going to be hard, and then you just make it about the journey, I think you have a different circumstance that you'll come out with at the end.
Absolutely right. Because that what you described perfectly describes how someone gets lost is that the way that we pull back when things get difficult.
Right.
You know, that's the whole problem. So to think you can get out of the problem, you know, the symptom might be overeating or using alcohol, but that's not the actual problem. The reason you're there is because you're not able to put yourself in those uncomfortable circumstances. So yeah, I think you're spot on in translating that to other areas of our life. And in fact, for me, you know, I joked with a friend one time. I was on a training run, and he didn't even know anything about, you know, my story or my journey. And he asked me, he heard, he's like, did I hear that you used to weigh 300 plus pounds? And what was that all about? He just knew me as a runner. And I said as a joke, I was like, yeah, you know, if I'd have known it was going to be this hard, I'd have probably done it a lot sooner. And I was just trying to, you know, I was just kind of joking, you know, I'm kind of a, you know, smart aleck kind of guy. But when I said it, I was like, man, there's so much truth to that statement. Like, yeah. I needed the emotional stakes to be high, and I needed something that, you know, if it didn't seem impossible, it didn't seem worth doing, you know, and I knew I needed to make myself uncomfortable and have to figure it out from there. Yes. And that right there is the entire essence of what ultra running is. It's putting yourself in an impossible situation, one that you know you're going to want to quit, you're going to want to stop, and you have to just figure it out. You have to just move through it.
Yeah, when it comes to dealing with physical, emotional, or mental or spiritual pain, I have a mentor of mine who constantly reminds me of the old adage, you can't go over it, you can't go around it, you've got to go through it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So when it comes to running, when you started at 320 pounds, like, did you have physical limits?
No, I was able to run a sub 2-hour marathon right off. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I had a lot of pushback from my body, you know? And, you know, if we kind of come full circle back to when you said that that everyone else calls me crazy.
Yeah.
And I said crazy is a powerful tool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you do have to be willing to be crazy. To make some crazy change, to accomplish something really big, I think you do need to be crazy. And that was proof of it right there, because I had to ignore all of the overwhelming evidence that was coming in on a daily basis that was telling me that I'm never going to be able to run.
Right.
You know, I mean, I would run and my shins hurt and my back hurt, and I could run about 15 seconds at a time. And, you know, it was just a miserable, miserable experience. And, you know, but I decided that this was it, that, you know, this, for whatever reason, I made this my stand, that I was going to figure this out and that I was going to run a marathon, you know. And it was before like Biggest Loser. So I didn't even know that was even a possibility, you know, that, you know, now we see people running marathons and doing things all the time, it seems like, on TV, but I didn't even have that affirmation out there.
Why do you feel like people fail at losing weight long-term?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as a gym owner and a trainer, you know, it's one that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And I think my personal take on it is there's two main components to that. And, you know, the most important one, you know, people don't fail because they're not strong enough, or they don't have enough willpower, or, you know, because it's, you know, too hard even. I think the biggest problem is that people don't believe they can do it, right? They get frustrated, they get discouraged, and they quit because they don't think it's possible. So I think that the number one thing is commitment. And, you know, I think we have this concept that we can somehow be partially committed to something, that we can be 90% or 99% committed to something, and it's just not real. You know, commitment is a yes or no thing.
Right.
And when you're 100% committed to something, that means you will keep going until it happens, right? Your body allocates resources based on what it's committed to. And we're like crazy survival creatures, human beings. We can do anything, but we can't access that kind of seemingly superhuman power until we're 100% committed. So I think that's a big step that people miss out on, is truly making the commitment to doing it. And, you know, what ties kind of right into that is, you know, we try to change ourselves by changing our behaviors, right? We think, you know, I need to lose weight, so I need to eat less, or I need to eat healthier, or I need to work out more. And we really get focused on, you know, kind of the superficial part of that, like what we do on a daily basis. And that seems intuitive, right? That seems a smart way to do it. But when our image or our concept of who we are doesn't match our behaviors, then we're kind of in that conflict place, right? So you can, in other words, if you look at yourself as a fat person, person, if that's how you identify who you are, I'm the person that can't lose weight no matter what I do. I'm the person who's big boned or, you know, born with a slow metabolism, and you throw all this junk on who you are as a person, and then you, you know, get motivated and decide to go on a workout plan, you know, that initial motivation will carry you for a little bit, but eventually that's going to run out, you know, and eventually what's going to happen is you're going to go, why am I spending all this time in the gym when I'm really just a fat person? I'm eventually going to fail at this anyway, and then you scrap it.
Right.
And one of the things I go to in my book is what I had to do with myself and what I do with my clients is really work on breaking down that identity, you know, and creating a new one. You know, we can be anything we choose. You know, it's not written in the stars that we're supposed to be one way or another. So once we decide, you know, who we are, for me, it was deciding that I was going to be a runner, that that's who I was going to be. And I was going to be the kind of person that didn't dream of using drugs and alcohol. And then I only engaged in behaviors that supported that view. And once that identity kind of made the switch, once you get over that initial gap, then my behaviors and everything fell in line naturally. It wasn't a struggle anymore.
Yeah, so you went more upstream to fix the problem rather than constantly dealing with the downstream.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I love that. So can you tell me a bit about the Superman Project?
Yeah, so the Superman Project, it started, you know, it's funny because, you know, my friends sometimes will give me a little crap on the name thinking that, you know, that I'm trying to say that I'm Superman, and I'm not. I couldn't be anything farther from that. But the concept of the Superman Project came from my son, who he saw me change. You know, he was 8 at the time when I finished my first 100-mile trail run, and he kind of remembered me as being 300-plus pounds, and at the finish, he said, Dad, you turned into Superman.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, no, I didn't, but, you know, we all have a Superman inside, and we only need to access it for one day, and that one day is all it takes to change a life. And after I said that to him, you know, I realized that I had kind of, you know, come up with the whole tagline, if you will, of what my life philosophy was. And so it kind of stuck with me for a while, and, you know, I wanted to do something meaningful with my running. So I was trying to find a charity to support and run for. And, you know, there's so many good ones out there, but I couldn't find one that really matched up with what I wanted to do, which is to inspire people to change, to show them that they can do anything. So I started the Superman Project, and we're just a super small outfit. You know, we're not a real big thing, but we write training plans and coaching plans and do counseling for people who are trying to find sobriety through endurance sports. So we just want to show that we're all Superman, you know, we're all Wonder Woman, we're all anything we decide to be, if you're willing to just kind of be crazy, be stupid, and go make it happen.
And so on the endurance sports thing, I think we've already talked about it, but to summarize, would you say that endurance sports keeps your body and mind strong because it seems like it's something that's impossible, but through the pursuit of that thing, you become stronger?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think that, you know, anyone who's made a dramatic change in their life, such as finding recovery, going from a place where you couldn't go a day without using or drinking, and then somehow you find the ability to live without alcohol, now that's a genuine miracle, right? And that took almost a superhuman strength. And
yeah.
When I read the words that I wrote in my book, and it puts me back in that place of where I was and how lost I was and how desperate I was, it seems overwhelming to me that I got to where I am today. So there's that sense of, you know, I touched this superhuman power one day, you know? And for me, ultra running is a moving affirmation of that, you know, that if I can run 135 miles across Death Valley, if I can, you know, do Boston Marathon 4 times in one day and put myself in these situations where I just want to quit, that it hurts, it's painful, but I see it through, I find a way, I touch that strength, it's like an affirmation that I'll be okay forever, even if the, you know, urge to use drugs and alcohol ever comes back, that I still have access to that superhuman part of me that we all have.
Yeah, I love that. So as you were on this journey, were you pursuing this with doctor guidance? Because like you just said, this endurance sport can be really hard on the body, especially for somebody who was coming from the place you were coming from.
You know, I did not have like medical supervision. I had the support of a lot of people within the running community itself.
Okay.
Some of which were encouraging, some of which were not. I recommend to anyone trying to start a program that they do take the time to do that, because I could have potentially run some roadblocks, but I got lucky. And, you know, I just was, because of the place that I was starting at was so low, you know, I almost had this aversion to any possibility that someone would tell me to stop. I didn't want to hear that. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Absolutely. So for somebody who isn't maybe, say, dealing with weight loss or addiction, what can they get from reading your book, your autobiography, Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery?
I think that the reason, you know, the book has done as well as it has up to this point is a reflection, you know, not on me or not on ultra marathoning, but on the fact that I think every single human being knows instinctively somewhere that there's a better version of themselves, right? That they can do more, that they're stronger than they think they are. And my story, I think, makes for an interesting case study. You know, it's the extremes of it, right? Not everyone needs to lose 160 pounds, or not everyone wants to run across Death Valley, but we all want to become a better version of ourselves. And in writing my story, you know, I didn't write it necessarily to be a book that I was going to release. I was writing it to kind of sort through what I dealt with internally, you know, during the process. It was kind of like a spiritual moral inventory that I was taking.
And oh, I love that.
I went at it from inside, which is why I shared, you know, so much in the book, like everything that I've done, thought, every embarrassing moment, every fear, every doubt, it's all in there. And I didn't realize that I was kind of creating a blueprint that would transfer over to someone else. Maybe not everybody, you know, but I think that we're all much more alike than we are different. So the fact that I went through this and could communicate it in a way that might make sense to someone else could help them find their own kind of strength and strong place to make their own change.
All right, David, this has been such a great interview. I'm so grateful that you agreed to join me today on air in Reno, Nevada.
I'm actually heading to Nevada in a couple of weeks for the Badwater 135 out there in Death Valley coming up.
Oh, boy. Well, best of luck to you on that. For people who want to learn more, you can check it out, thesupermanproject.org. The man is David Clark. The story Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery. Thank you so much, David.
100% my pleasure.
All right. Have a great day, man.
You too.
Bye.
So when you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going to want to take a
you
left.
You are not going to
Then what you're
going to
do is turn onto Marcy
Avenue.
Just
broke up.
And go past
and
the first three lights
happy
and then
it.
Take the next left.
I don't really
drive
think
five
she's
more
happy,
blocks
but
in. You should be
who
there.
Who am I to judge, right?
Park
anyway,
on the right. That's
I'll
what
see
I
you
heard
later
last
tonight.
Night.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text. Stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
There's a part of our world that we pay little attention to. Here, an ant drags a seed five times its own size. A grasshopper devours a fresh leaf. And a bee sips from a drop of dew. And down here, toxic chemicals and carcinogens are leaching into our environment. They come from objects that we look past every day. Littered cigarette butts. Every one is a tiny, toxic waste site. And there are millions of them. Right where we live, work, and play. Let's stop the toxic litter. Learn more at rethinkbutts.org. Brought to you by Legacy and Leave No Trace.
Hi, I'm Lynn Warney, President of the Nevada State Education Association. The more that you read, the more things you will know. The more that you learn, the more places you'll go. Hi, I'm Lynn Warney, President of the Nevada State Education Association. Dr. Seuss was right. Reading is the key to learning. Studies have shown that kids who read and are read too do better in school and in life. The best part is, It doesn't matter what you read, the classics or the comics. Whatever sparks a student's interest. Football, dance, trains, there's a book about it just waiting to be read, a door just waiting to open. And if your student hasn't found the joy of reading yet, try thinking outside the book. Read baseball cards together. Try doing crossword puzzles or word games, or have your child read a favorite recipe to you. They read, you measure the chocolate chips. Encouraging a love of reading now is a gift that pays off over a lifetime. So go read and help a child succeed.
A message from the Nevada State Education Association.